So good morning, I'm Lynn Madden. I'm the President of the Australasian Faculty of Public Health Medicine. I managed to get it right that time. I'd also like to start by showing my respects and our joint respects to the traditional owners of the land on where we meet today, who are the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay our respects to the elders past and present. And I'd also like to welcome all Indigenous people from Indigenous Australians and New Zealanders who may be present. I'd also like to welcome the state officers who are participating today. Their images will come up as questions are asked later. But thank you very much for joining us today. I know that we're actually operating across a very broad time span, and a welcome across that time span that stretches from Western Australia to New Zealand. And I know that many people are also linking through their personal computers this morning across Australia and also across New Zealand. So again, welcome to you all. The format this morning will be that Nick Watts will speak first. We'll take some questions of clarification from the floor here in Sydney, and then Tony Capon will speak. Following that, we will hopefully have allowed ourselves so that we can actually take questions from all our sites, including here in Sydney. So that's the format that we will follow this morning. I will also throw two questions from our remote sites first, to give you a chance to have a word first. So have your questions ready in the remote sites, please. I'll now introduce our speakers for this morning. Nick Watts, Dr. Nick Watts, trained at the University of Western Australia, and it's a great pleasure to have Nick here in Sydney with us this morning. He initially trained as an economist and then has further qualifications in population health, also gained at the University of Western Australia, and also in public policy, which he achieved at University College London. Nick currently holds two incredibly important positions, and both those important positions are actually informing his presentation this morning. The first of those is that he is the Executive Director of the Lancet Countdown, tracking progress on health and climate change. And this is a multidisciplinary and international research collaboration with many academic centres around the world. And it is based at University College London, Institute of Global Health. The second important position that Nick holds is as the Director of the UK Health Alliance on Climate Change, and this brings together many of the UK's major health institutions, including the Lancet BMA, the Royal College of Physicians, the Royal College of Nursing, to work together to support the health profession, to work for change, to accelerate the transition towards a healthier climate. So there Nick brings both those perspectives to his presentation this morning. Our second presenter this morning is Professor Tony Capon, and Tony is the inaugural Professor of Planetary Health at Sydney University, and we believe is the first Professor of Planetary Health on the planet, which is quite a nice little sort of thing to be, isn't it? Tony, Tony had a distinguished history here as a public health physician and held positions as public health unit director in Western Sydney prior to becoming the Global Health, the Director of the Global Health Institute at the United Nations University. So two very distinguished presenters and a very, very important topic, which is going to be about climate change and health. I'll invite Nick then to get underway.
I'll take this. Giving me a microphone is always dangerous because I've never had a problem with being too quiet, but we'll see how we go. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Pleasure.
Tony, to the RACP for inviting me down here. It's been great to come back down to Australia after being away for a little bit too long. It's great to be in a place where I don't have to explain my sort of dark sense of humour and where I don't have to explain the clearly correct pronunciation of the word data, which is I only have two or three jokes, so a few people in the room have already heard that joke. Okay. No, it is actually true. Okay, so I thought we could maybe spend 20 minutes talking through partly a little bit of sort of the background of why myself as sort of a medical doctor would be working in health and climate change, and why sort of climate change is relevant to some of the work that that some of the institutions Lynn mentioned, and the patients and the sort of public they represent. And then perhaps also provide a few examples or give some perspectives of what is happening around the world, what's happening in other countries. The sort of particular area I know about is in the United Kingdom, but there's plenty happening all over, and I think we have maybe 20 minutes to talk through that, if that sounds interesting. If not, there's some fantastic breakfast coffee outside. Let's see how we go. So this is one of the very many fairly unhelpful diagrams that get put up trying to summarize the links between public health and climate change. It's unhelpful because there are links everywhere, and people keep trying because it can sometimes be a little bit harder. I sometimes find it a little bit hard to conceptualize. I've most easily summarized it for myself by thinking about it this way. Climate change, through a whole range of different emissions particulates, is trapping more energy into a closed system, into the Earth's atmospheric system. When you trap more energy into a closed system, you increase the volatility, you increase sort of the energy that comes out. And we see that in the form of changes in weather. For the most part, the impacts we see from climate change are the result of an interaction of this energy starting at the equator and then being distributed out through the currents and the wind systems, and the interaction of those currents and those wind systems, which now have more energy in them, result in changing weather. And so this diagram tries to capture that. We break it up into those direct impacts of climate change on human health. These are the things that go straight from the weather to human health. And you can see there, we talk about heat wave, sort of flood, drought, storms, extreme weather events. And it's very difficult to capture precisely what's going to happen in any one location or at any one time, but at a very general level, sort of the statement of increased frequency, severity, duration is something that gets thrown around and is tracked by a whole range of different institutions, both today and into the future. Indirectly, all of these extreme events, the changes in flood and drought, interact with the social systems, the environmental systems that we've set up to sustain life, the various environmental determinants of health, good food, good air, shelter. And you see climate change start to influence those impacts, whether it's from the flood, the drought, or the heat, leading to decreased agricultural yield and the impact that has on childhood nutrition. We expect an additional 43 million children undernourished under the age of 5 by 2050 in Southeast Asia alone. So when you start to talk about sort of climate level or planetary level changes, you start to capture very, very big numbers simply because of the scale of what we're touching on. And then that final, let's say greenish colored set of boxes is just a reminder that all of this is socially mediated. All of this depends on the impacts that are experienced, depend on the populations that are being affected. And to that end, where there are existing inequalities within and between countries, climate change works to exacerbate that. Very briefly, in Australia, I'm just going to talk through and use a couple of diagrams. I'm not going to talk in any comprehensive sense about some of these impacts, but from the work that we do with The Lancet on their countdown for health and climate change, we track on an annual basis the impacts of climate change on human health in every country. And so here is our sort of first set, and we provide change in temperature as sort of something that's particularly concerning in Australia. Not just change in temperature, but increase in heat wave frequency, strength, severity. We talk a lot about, they won't show up too much, so how about we, there we go. We talk a lot about changes in the pattern of vector-borne disease, in the sort of spread, in the distribution, and the burden of those vectors. The little red line there outlines Australia, and that's a model we've created going back from 1950 to 2015, tracking the transmission and vectorial capacity of dengue fever through Aegypti and Albopictus. over time, you see that it starts to get sort of concerningly, increasingly easy for that vector to transmit, mostly as a result of some of the climactic factors, increased precipitation, more still water, and more favorable temperature. And then finally, this graph down the bottom here, whilst the other two are historical, they're talking about climate change to date up until 2015, 2016. This one down the bottom here is looking at a projection of exposure to extremes of drought. The blue line there talks about what we would expect to see from now until the end of the century in terms of additional drought exposure just from climate change. What we find when we look very closely from a public health perspective at the sort of vulnerabilities of people exposed to that drought is that when you consider who it is that's being exposed, people are actually aging, they're migrating, and they are moving into areas worst affected by climate change. And so there's a form of maladaptation happening around the world, and that the exposure, the additional exposure we talk about in drought around the world and in Australia is actually much higher than I think was probably previously estimated. This slide is just a nice slide I steal from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and I like it because it's talking about the impacts of climate change all around the world, but it's talking about the ones that they're observing today. And you'll notice that there's a change in the way that we're starting to talk about climate change. It's no longer something that's happening in 2050 or by the end of the century. It's something that people are experiencing today and is worsening day on day. Apparently there's a positive side to the story as well, and it works through the same causal pathways. Insofar as climate change impacts adversely human health, the response to climate change yields some fairly unprecedented benefits for human health. Some simple examples looking at all of the carbon emissions in the transport sector. That transport sector, particularly in the United Kingdom, we know has two major sort of health externalities. One, it stops people from walking, cycling, it decreases levels of physical activity. And it also results in an additional 40,000 deaths from air pollution, from compounds of nitrogen oxide, sulfuric oxide, particulate matter, ultrafine particles. A response that electrifies the transport fleet, encourages physical activity, is good for climate change and helps to prevent some of those threats, but it also goes a long, long way to improving public health. It's a sensible, cost-effective health intervention in its own right, regardless of what you think about climate change. And we see that the whole way through the system, whether we're talking about in power generation, the way we build and construct our cities or our houses, the way we think about and manage our health systems. And it was those arguments that led, this is the first of the groups I'm going to talk to briefly, it was those arguments, both the health impacts of climate change and the health co-benefits of climate mitigation, the benefits of the response, that led these groups here up on screen to come together. They came together at the start of last year in the form of the UK Health Alliance on Climate Change. They represent many, almost all of the medical royal colleges, the Royal College of Nursing, the Lancet, the British Medical Journal, the Royal Society of Medicine, the Royal Pharmaceutical Society, and a few other stragglers, the Faculty of Public Health, the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Health. They're stragglers only because I can't group them all into Royal College. The Alliance came together in recognition of some of those issues, and also in recognition of the fact that a lot of what we wanted to do to respond to climate change was stuff that the Royal College of Paediatrics wanted to do anyway in terms of tackling obesity, or something that the Royal College of Physicians wanted to do anyway in terms of tackling the air pollution issues that London and the rest of the United Kingdom has. And so the Alliance is there. It exists with two main purposes: to support the medical and health profession in responding to climate change in their own way, and to engage with government in the United Kingdom. We have a slightly different situation with sort of government in the UK than there is here, perhaps, or in the United States. And so it's been quite a collaborative process engaging with the links on sort of climate change and public health. To give an example of what this looks like. In the United Kingdom, coal-fired power is responsible for 32% of the national energy mix, or was responsible for 32% of the national energy mix. It also results from the ultrafine particulates and the heavy metals, compounds of sulfuric oxide, in more deaths every year than motor vehicle accidents do. This is the air pollution that comes from the coal. It's important to start to phase out coal-fired power from a climate change perspective, because of the significant contribution it provides globally and the leadership that the UK can provide in in sort of providing that early mitigation and that clear signal. So the Alliance commissioned a series of studies through the Royal College of Physicians and the Royal College of Paediatrics and Child Health, looking at the sort of effects of air pollution from, among other things, coal-fired power plants. Came up with its new set of figures, both in terms of the mortality and the health costs, the cost of the healthcare system in the NHS, and then a set of policy recommendations. It did this in large part because, in collaboration with the Department of Energy and Climate Change and the Department of Business, Energy, and Industrial Strategy, the government was very keen to do some of this anyway. But they were concerned that when they tried to announce phasing out coal in the United Kingdom, which is a huge step, no country has ever unilaterally declared that, it would be seen as something that was sort of almost a job killer. That was the narrative they were concerned about. They came to the UK Health Alliance asking for help to change that narrative, because they knew that the message that public health could provide and that medicine could provide was so much more powerful. This wasn't about killing jobs, and this wasn't about climate change. This was about saving lives. This was about improving public health. And so the Alliance commissioned these studies, published them, launched the studies in a series of reports, and then lined up and prepared health professionals from all around the country, ready to respond and ready to help communicate the announcement when it came. With that support, with joint letters from all of the Royal College presidents in the country to the Prime Minister and to Cabinet, and a series of meetings with Cabinet, somewhere through December 2016, the government announced a unilateral phase out of coal-fired power. And the Alliance was there, and the Royal Colleges were there, ready to change that narrative, ready to make sure that this was understood for what it was, for something that was a sensible public health intervention. I'm relying on you to tell me.
You go.
Okay. Fine. That's one side of what the Alliance does. It engages with government and helps provide that sort of guidance on sensible public health policy. But it also looks to engage with the public on behalf of the profession and engage with the medical and the nursing profession itself. And to that end, about a month and a half ago, the Alliance ran the first ever National Clean Air Day, or National Clean Air and Climate Day, making the links between steps that you can sort of implement to mitigate climate change and things that you should be doing around air pollution. We did this in partnership with the Department for Environment in the UK and with Public Health England, the UK's sort of public health, or England's public health body. And this took a whole bunch of different forms. It took the form of another set of studies looking at where those emissions and where the air pollution was in London and how that sort of linked up to the locations of the different hospitals and health centres. There's a large infographic up on the BMJ's website that sort of talks through that and talks through the exposure that particularly vulnerable populations, patients with heart disease, respiratory disease, are experiencing from air pollution. I don't have a copy here, but it ended up on the front page of the Nursing Standard, the Nursing Times, and the British Medical Journal. And importantly, was through the magazines, through the sort of articles of the various colleges, was sort of distributed out to the members. There was also a series of interviews with the Mayor of London, and that's now being taken forward to look at in more detail how the Alliance can support what London is doing. As a bit of a sort of beacon for the rest of the United Kingdom, and had a set of air quality monitors, which I think is particularly exciting. There's about 5,000 small, sort of relatively inexpensive, 50 pence air quality monitors that are distributed amongst health professionals in the UK now, allowing them to track what the air pollution is around their clinic and around their sort of, you know, trip back and forth to work. This is then mapped up, and in about 6 months we'll be able to sort of provide a slightly more comprehensive look at what that looks like across the country. What's really important or useful about that is what happens when you notice how bad the air is there. Is it provides you with a whole range of examples and steps and things that an individual clinician can do in order to firstly reduce their impact that they're having on climate change and on air pollution, and also help protect their patients. Is a particular innovation from the Royal College of GPs, which I think is great.
So was 50 pence a slip of the tongue? Or was 50 pence what you meant to say?
Yeah, so they're very, very, yes. So the question was whether 50 pence was the right cost. Yeah, that's what they cost. A normal, very large, a proper air quality monitor costs about £100. These are very cheap because they are using a clever proxy for carbon monoxide as a proxy of combustion, and they are also not battery powered. Concerningly, they are powered by the radio waves that are sort of in the ambient atmosphere in the United Kingdom. So they don't have a battery, they just have a receiver that picks that up. We have friends, and we've worked recently to start to set up friends in other countries. This is a new alliance that's just come on into existence. I think it has a slightly ridiculous name. The Medical Society Consortium on Climate and Health. It's our equivalent of a friend in the United States, and is coming not a second too late. Has just come into existence there as well. 5 minutes, sure. I can finish off soon. In the United Kingdom, there's also this example, which I was saying last night, I'm very good at putting up graphs and diagrams that don't do a particularly good job of explaining things, but are just a nice background to look at while I talk. This is talking about the emissions of the healthcare system in the United Kingdom, the emissions of the National Health Service. In 2008, the Climate Change Act in the UK was passed, mandating a whole range of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emission reductions from 2008 through to the mid-century and beyond. As part of that piece of legislation, the NHS had a commitment that it had to make in terms of reducing its own emissions. And that was initially concerning until when they looked at everything they wanted to do to reduce the emissions of the National Health Service, they realized that large, large parts of it were just sensible things they wanted to do anyway. Investing in primary care, decreasing transport, local procurement for goods and pharmaceuticals, sort of local community access to nutrition for the hospitals. And so the NHS set up the Sustainable Development Unit and went about beginning to deliver on that. And at the start of this year, they were supposed to have reached a 10% reduction in their emissions from 1990 levels. They reported an 11% reduction, which is really quite a remarkable achievement for a healthcare system the size of the NHS, one of the largest employers in the world and by far the largest emitter of carbon dioxide greenhouse gases in sort of the UK public sector. The even more remarkable thing about that overshoot of 1% is about the same size as the entire national emissions of Malta. So that gives you a sense of how big the NHS is and how impressive that achievement is. I'm going to finish off very quickly. Those are two examples in the UK, one talking about the UK Health Alliance on climate change, the other talking about the Sustainable Development Unit and what's happening within the system, sort of demonstrating that the health profession really at a system-wide level is starting to respond. Finally, talking about some work that the Lancet is doing. It's also nice to be in a room where I don't have to explain what the Lancet is. The Lancet, following a series of commissions in climate change and health in 2009 and 2015, a commission on planetary health that Tony was involved in 2015, has committed itself to publishing on an annual level those indicators. I showed you a few slides off before. Annual indicators of the impacts of climate change on human health across every country, and annual indicators of the response to climate change, tracking and comparing how countries are doing in terms of their adaptation, their mitigation, and importantly, the health benefits that they're realizing from that, demonstrating that if, on the one hand, climate change is this enormous threat to public health, on the other hand, the response to climate change is an opportunity, demonstrating that transition, a world that's moving from climate change as a threat to an opportunity, and the health benefits that come from that. Got a lot of logos. It's a large research collaboration led out of University College London, but as you can see, with partners from every continent, from all around the world, from academic institutions and UN agencies. A large part of the reason why I'm down here is to work with Professor Capon to look at how the University of Sydney and how other Australian institutions can start to engage with this collaboration, because I suppose, as well as a research body, we're also a body that's trying to sort of practice what we preach. And so each of these institutions are beginning to also set up their own national versions of, or many of these institutions are beginning to set up their own national versions of the Lancet Countdown, tracking those indicators at a national level. And that's something that I think we'd love to see in more countries. Anyway, that's me, and that's everything. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Before we continue, just seeking any further points of clarification from Nick. Otherwise, we'll continue on. And I'll introduce Professor Tony Capon.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Nick. I think you've given us a terrific introduction to this discussion. And clearly, there's a lot for us to learn from that experience in the United Kingdom. What I'm going to do probably in about 10 minutes or so is just reflect on some of the things that we are doing in Australia from the perspective of health and climate change. And I think when I speak with some regularity to people like Richard Horton and others, they are impressed by the long-standing concern and efforts of selected health individuals here in this country and some societies. And I think this is one good example of an achievement in this country. The three college position statements on climate change and health published last year. Corey Watts, of course, was a key player in making this happen, but it was the college as a whole. And I think that this was progress for the college, and I think we should acknowledge that and celebrate that progress. This is another very important piece of work that I know Peter Sainsbury and others in the room, Kate Charlesworth, have been active in. And this is the work of the Australian Climate and Health Alliance, led from that alliance, but again, a network of concerned health professional organisations that went through a process over perhaps 18 months or so to develop this national strategy on climate, health and wellbeing consultation document, essentially putting in front of Australian elected officials the need for a national strategy on this theme. And you'll see there that it was launched in Canberra in the middle of this year. And quite remarkably, folk from the three major parties spoke in the context of that launch. And that attracted international attention, that it was something where health was uniting across party political perspectives in this context. And I think that's a key message from what Nick is saying, is that health is a natural integrator when we think about these questions. Lynn here is now leading work with Medical Deans Australia and New Zealand. So this is essentially a council of all of the deans of medical schools in Australia and New Zealand, and they have agreed under Lynn's leadership to have an initiative on climate change and health, looking at where this best fits into the medical curriculum across the country. And for me, this is a major advance for us in this region. And Lynn may reflect a little bit on this in the discussion, if there's an opportunity. But again, it's in the context of international collaborations. Lynn and Notre Dame are part of the Global Consortium on Climate and Health Education based at Columbia University in New York. Again, back here locally, we're currently leading two upcoming themed issues of one of the MJA. I'm working closely with Nick Talley, of course, former president of the college here, on a themed issue on planetary health to be published by May next year in advance of our next RACP Congress here in Sydney. And at the same time, we're working with Public Health Research and Practice, which, if you don't know it, it's a really valuable journal for policymakers and practitioners in particular in public health. Originally, it was called the New South Wales Public Health Bulletin. And as it happens, Lynn was the editor for many years. And this is in fact the third issue of that journal, a collection of papers on climate change and health. And when Lynn was the editor, I co-edited two different issues of it. In 2009, we did one on the health impacts of climate change. And I think in 2011, we did one on the health co-benefits from the transitions that we need to make. So that journal, through its history, has been very supportive, and we'll have another issue coming out in September next year. This man is the man that leads the NHS Sustainable Development Unit, David Pension. He is the founding director. He's been in post for almost 10 years. This is the unit that's done the work to constrain the carbon footprint of the UK health system. And we're delighted to say that David's going to spend a month with us next year, hosted principally by us at the University of Sydney. During that period, he, as Lynn has skillfully managed with her Faculty of Public Health Medicine colleagues, he is going to be the opening keynote speaker for next year's Congress, which is on the theme of disruption for healthy futures. So, I mean, the theme was already chosen, but to have David Pension opening the conference, I understand immediately followed or on the same day by Alistair Woodward from New Zealand giving the Redfern oration. So I think that's going to be an important occasion for us as a college, and to have David with us for a month will be an important opportunity for the country. And anybody, including folk who are with us this morning from other states, please feel free to reach out, because I'm sure that David will be happy to catch a train or a bus to other parts of Australia. He doesn't go in the air, so he's coming to Australia by train and to East Asia from London, and then he's catching a freighter from either Shanghai or Yokohama to Australia, and he's going to do that when he returns as well. Again, in the more local context, particularly for the people in the room here in Sydney, New South Wales now has a climate change policy framework, which was advanced by the current Premier and her government late last year. And these, with two primary objectives, to achieve net zero emissions by 2050 and to make New South Wales more resilient to a changing climate. You can download this document from the website. There are specific mentions of health in this document, high up in the document, reducing climate change impacts on health and, importantly, capturing co-benefits. One of the things that's part of this is the need for new knowledge that's relevant to decision making. And we've been funded at the University of Sydney to develop a knowledge node on the human health and social impacts of climate change. And that was the node that supported the workshop we had earlier in the week with Nick on mental health and climate change here. Now, of course, these are documents. The real challenge is to make it happen. And but importantly, at least the door is open now in New South Wales. We are using the term climate change again in the policy debate. And that in itself is progress in a country like Australia. Just a few words as I wrap things up about some of the things that are happening following the Lancet Commission on Planetary Health that Nick mentioned earlier that I was part of in 2015. And for those of you that don't know, there's now a new Lancet title, a monthly journal, open access, the inaugural issue in April. So we're up to about issue 5 now, and all the articles are free for download from that web link. We're also part of a broad international collaboration called Future Earth, which is essentially, as you can see from the top there, an international research platform that aims to provide knowledge and support to accelerate transformations to a sustainable world. So this is across all disciplines. The the natural sciences, the social sciences, the health sciences, humanities. It's a 10-year initiative that came from Rio Plus 20. And as it happens, the chair of the science committee is an Australian, Mark Stafford Smith from CSIRO. And he's coming up to Sydney in a couple of months to open up a broader conversation with academics here in the city about this. And you'll see there at the bottom of the slide, one part of it is what we call a health knowledge action network. So building knowledge about health in the context of sustainability that's relevant to decisions made by governments, by industry and communities. And that's called a Health Can, and I'm part of the development team for that process. So just this final slide about a new initiative that I'm leading at the University of Sydney, where at this stage we're just simply calling it the University of Sydney's Planetary Health Initiative. It's multidisciplinary across all of the faculties, and clearly we need to work closely with groups like the Charles Perkins Centre, which I expect you're well familiar with if you're in this city, the new multidisciplinary centre working specifically on global epidemics of obesity and chronic diseases, the Mara Bashir Institute, which takes an ecological view of infectious diseases, the Brain and Mind Centre, which again is looking in a multidisciplinary way at mental health challenges, the Sydney Institute of Agriculture and others, all on a new platform for planetary health. We'll be launching this initiative on the Thursday, the 14th of December. All welcome to come along. Lancet editor Richard Horton will be in town and give a public lecture at the Charles Perkins Centre. A couple of other specific things that are upcoming for particularly relevant to people in Sydney here with us today. A roundtable with Global Green and Healthy Hospitals Policy Director Scott Slotterback. I know a number of folk in the room are already part of that discussion. And again, we can thank Fiona Armstrong from the Climate and Health Alliance for connecting Scott with us. He's going to be in the city for the Health Service Managers Conference here in Sydney this year. So to me, that's great that the Health Service Managers are stepping up and inviting Scott as one of their speakers. The second last dot point there, an important initiative that Greg Stewart is leading, working with us. So joint initiative between Southeastern Sydney Local Health District, Southwestern Sydney Local Health District with Stephen Connerty, and importantly, Wiser Healthcare. We're going to have a workshop on planetary health and what that means for New South Wales Local Health Districts on Wednesday, the 1st of November. Wiser Healthcare, if you don't know it, is the initiative that looks at overdiagnosis and overtreatment and the human health harms from that, and we're encouraging them to think about the environmental harms as well. And so Alex Barrett from the University of Sydney, Les Erwig, who many of you would know, are engaging in this now, which is terrific. And so if you'd like more information about what we're doing, there's the beginnings of our website. And Lynn, that was really all I wanted to say. And I think the key message that I often leave people with, and it won't be necessarily new for most of you in the room, is that the health messages are so enormously important in the context of climate change and other global changes for three reasons. Firstly, because it makes it personal. You know, our older people in our communities, our young people, are already dying in the context of climate change, in heat waves, for example, in extreme bushfires, for example, in this country. So it makes it personal. It's not an abstract future thing. It's real, it's now. And related to that, it makes it urgent. That second thing, we have to act. In fact, we should have already acted, as Tony McMichael, when he sounded the alarm about these issues way back in 1993 with his book, Planetary Overload, was calling for. So it makes it personal, it makes it urgent, and then that final message, the one that Nick advanced through, I think, very well in his talk earlier, that there's a positive story to tell about the transformations that we need to make. It doesn't need to be a negative thing for us. We don't have to think of this as a constraint on our well-being or our way of life, because less is more in relation to consumption. You know, in a country like Australia, very high, you know, material benefits, material standards of living, but lots and lots of unhappy people. Way too many people depressed and taking antidepressants in this country. And to me, that's a sign that all of this material success is not actually improving our way of life. And so we need to challenge that, and we will benefit as we constrain our consumption to make room for more development in other countries. And so the final message that, you know, if everybody in the world lived as Australians do, we would need five planets. That's very disturbing, and it means that we have to contract our consumption to about 20% of what it is now so that we can share the planet with all of the people that live in the world. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Tony.